You're tuned into Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson. Mother. When we hear this word, we tend to think of our own mothers or our own experience in mothering children. Rarely in the Western world does it conjure up images of the feminine divine. Yet for Savitri Bess, the search for the Great Mother began some 30 years ago, leading her to abandon her college teaching career and live in an ashram, where she, living as a monastic, taught Hinduism, yoga, and meditation. After subsequently founding and directing the Center for Creative Consciousness in Tucson, Arizona, she began a journey into the dark side of the feminine, and in 1992 met a woman many believe to be the Black Mother Kali incarnate, Mata Amritananda Mayi, more widely known as Amachi. It has been through Savitri's inner journey, along with guidance and inspiration from Amachi, that she penned two books, Offer Me a Flower, A Spiritual Quest, published by Bharati Impressions of Santa Fe, and The Path of the Mother, published by Valentine. I'd like to welcome Savitri to the show today.
Happy to be here.
Can you tell us more about what compelled you as a young person to seek out the divine in feminine form?
Well, I think in the book Offer Me a Flower, the part in the beginning that is based on an experience I had in childhood at our mountain cabin in above San Diego, where I had a divine experience, basically. I was walking along in the book. I tell about a wolf that the child meets, and then the mother dropping down from the trees, and that's sort of what it felt like. It felt like suddenly the mother dropping down from the trees into me. And it later, as a teen, I also wanted to be a Christian educator. And then when I went to college and I met Hindus, Jews, Buddhists, and Muslims, I couldn't justify it. And so I began my search at that time. And then while I was in Denmark on a Fulbright grant, I began taking yoga. And I had this experience of the mother being like a mother whale that who would take me home, basically. And then in 1992, I met Amaji. And I was in this huge tent in Santa Fe, 3,000 square foot tent with oriental rugs in the mountains, in the woods. And all of a sudden, this tiny little woman, about not even 5 feet tall, wearing white, came walking in. And it was like this extraordinary breeze of this mother whale. I knew. I began crying right there in that moment. And then to watch her hugging thousands of people, literally, men, women, and children, people going up with families and watching these huge basketball-type or football-type men crying while they were in her arms. It was just utterly, I was totally blown away. And when she left, which was 4 days later, I thought I'd be elevated, you know, feeling, oh boy, now I can get on with my life. And instead, I woke up in absolute, total despair. Where is she? How can I go to her? I called them up. She's in Texas. I can't afford to go to Texas. So what happened was I just laid down and I prayed to be able to go to India, to go to her ashram. And 2 days later, my storage shed was broken into and two European oriental rugs were stolen. And in that second, there was a second where I said, what's the good in this? Oh, I've got insurance on those rugs. So I collected insurance for the exact amount of a round-trip ticket to India and sold a few of my wall hangings. I was a fiber artist at the time, and I went off for 4 months, and that was the beginning of sort of the end, basically. My life ended the way it was, so to speak. I stopped being a therapist. I was a counselor. And I just, that was it. She was my life for quite a while. And actually, though, funny enough, at the end of those 4 months, I thought, okay, this is it. I don't need any more of this. I didn't get self-realized. I didn't go to heaven. I didn't die and go to heaven or anything like that, like I was planning on having happen in those 4 months. So when I went up to get my last hug before going home, she said in English, and she doesn't usually speak English. She doesn't want us to do that. So she doesn't speak English usually. And she said to me in English, come back. Mother says, come back. And it was like, I just totally, that was the end. And so I, you know, here she is unsolicited, knowing that I'm going and probably thinking I'll never come back, telling me to come back. So I did. And that was quite extraordinary. And also, the other interesting part about this story is that I had lived in an ashram in Pennsylvania for many years and had a teacher who was not perfect, so to speak. And so a lot of really terrible things happened, as people read about from, you know, a spiritual guru, so to speak. And so I was extremely wary. I was terrified, as a matter of fact, and I kept my distance from this woman over in India. And every time I would ask a question in my mind, well, what about this? Well, what about that? And she would answer it. And one day, in the back on the stage where she is, when she gives the darshan in the evening, all these people go rushing up and they push and they shove to be near her. And I sat in the back and I said, you know, I wonder, do I have to push and shove like this to get near you? And somebody came up, grabbed my purse and said, come, and sat me up right down next to her. I sat next to her for like 7 hours and had this extraordinary experience of all the people coming up to her as being her. As in everyone, when they'd push me or shove me, I'd feel this extraordinary love in my heart that it was her. Instead of looking at her, I was looking at all these people. How beautiful they are, these lame people, these ugly people, these smelly people, these beautiful people, everybody coming up, because she appeals to the poor. And so everybody comes to her. And there's no charge for her love. So it's definitely extraordinary. So then, after I'd spent another year there for actually 7 months, when I came home, I needed something to do. I felt I was ready to get back involved professionally. And so when she came to the United States in the summertime, I went and asked. You know, I was ready to go. If she wanted me to go and live with her in India, I was ready to do that. But I really was interested in writing a book that would involve her. Or I wondered, should I go back to making my wall hangings? And so I went and asked those three things. Should I write this book that has to do with you, or should I do my wall hangings, or what? What should I do? And she told me to write the book. So that's how this book, The Path of the Mother, with the divine guidance of the Holy Mother Ramaji, came to being.
Again, listeners, if you've just tuned in, we're speaking today with Savitri Bess, the author of The Path of the Mother, published by Ballantine Books. Savitri, you mention in Hinduism there are four levels of existence, and one of these levels is, or I don't know if it's a level, but it's a recurring theme of existence. You can give the right language for that. And kind of what is the part of that that we're in now, and what is the call for the Divine Mother?
Oh, okay. I see what your question is. You're talking about the ages, the four ages.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, in Hinduism, actually, Amma says these ages exist within us simultaneously. I think when you're in the state that she's in, there's no time. Everything is happening all at the same time. But if you go into the stage of time, and actually it equals the same time that physicists say that the universe began with the Big Bang, it actually coincides with the Hindu knowledge, what they already knew. But anyway, there are four ages that go on over and over again until they make the big one where the Big Bang started. The first one is the Satya Yuga, and that's where everything is perfect, basically. Animals speak, people speak to animals, and everybody's kind of like the Garden of Eden, so to speak. And then in the next age, the loss of perfection is 25%, so there's 75% righteousness, basically. And then in the next, there's 50% righteousness. And then in our age, which began approximately 4,000 years ago, is the age of Kali, which is the Kali Yuga, which means the age of the decline of righteousness. And people are basically 25% righteous. And it's actually not, it's bad in the sense it's hard to keep balance during that age, but it's actually somewhat like the seasons. During this age, it's the age of things dissolving and going to seed. So you could say that the task during this age is to hopefully, you know, keep a few people righteous so that the seed can be planted for the Satya Yuga to then start again. So it's actually easier in this age to attain enlightenment than any of the other ages. They've made it simple because the attraction to the unrighteousness is so strong. And so you can just do it through chanting your mantra or whatever, if you have one. Or even if you don't, you can make one up. You know, like Krishna or Jesus, or it doesn't matter, you know. So you're saying the name of God all the time, trying to have that on your mind all the time. And trying to do good all the time, trying to improve yourself, trying to, you know, look in your shadow, which I did, which I tend to do really intensely. And this Amaji was a very good person to do that with, because she really knows how to find her way in there.
Right. Yeah. I want to talk about that in a little bit in more detail. But there was some connection between the Divine Mother, the reemergence of the Divine Mother, and this particular age.
Oh, okay. Well, what happens is that when there is a decline of righteousness, you know, somebody like a Jesus is born. And so when this age began, the Kali Yuga began, Krishna was born. And he was a divine incarnation. And then Jesus was another divine incarnation. And now we're obviously in a really difficult time right now. And so a lot of people think that Amaji is the incarnation for now, or at least among them. There are maybe four or five people on the planet now that have that quality. But she has a huge operation. She's enormous charitable operations all over India with an 800-bed state-of-the-art hospital where free open-heart surgeries are given for free, hospices, orphanages, schools for poor people to learn computer sciences, universities, nursing schools. Now she's trying to help the prostitutes in the Calcutta area. And so she has this, and the president of India has donated his salary for her charitable activities. So it's huge what she is doing. And, you know, Mother Teresa also had a very big operation over there in that way. So Kali is with a long A. There's Kali Yuga, which is the age of the decline of righteousness, and then there's Kali, which is with a long A. And she's the sort of the one to come along and help us out of this difficulty, out of the unrighteousness. And a lot of people believe Amaji is an incarnation of Kali, basically. Is that what you're wondering about?
Yeah.
And then in my book, I've identified six stages along the path of the mother. You know, before I go into that, though, there was this wonderful man, he still lives. His name is Chandra Pillai. He's an Indian man who works as a senior physicist at the Los Alamos Laboratory, the home of the atom bomb. This is an extraordinary story because he's a very spiritual man working in a very intense place. He doesn't make bombs. He wants to use science for good. But he was always wanting to have Amaji come to his home, but it was too far away. And so he had this vision when he woke up in the middle of the night after having a very beautiful dream and went into his meditation room, and Amaji was in there in a vision. And then he had this vision of the universe being created and people dying and the microcosm of the universe and the macrocosm of the universe. He has an extraordinary vision. He had this question, why a woman? You know, why should we have a woman now? So, and Amaji herself says it would have been easier to have been a man at this point in time. But Chandra answered his own question. He said, it's a woman who has the patience and the love and the qualities of motherhood, the unconditional love that a mother has, and the forgiveness, the total 100% love to her child. Even if her child is a murderer, the mother will love the child. And so he said it's because we need this motherly love now, this pure love of the mother, that's why she came in the form of a woman. It's kind of unprecedented, really, to come as a woman.
Right. Yeah, I also like how you've given quotes of hers throughout the book. One of these, Once concentration is attained, you're in contact with the inner mother. That means your own self. Mm-hmm. Even when you meditate on the name or the form of a god or goddess or mother, you are in fact meditating on your own self, mm-hmm. not on some external object.
Yeah. I'm glad you found that quote, because that's the extraordinary thing about Amaya. She doesn't really want us to worship her. She lets us worship her because she knows that through our worship of her, we will find it in ourselves. And she goes way out of her way to force you back into the mother within by ignoring you for long periods of time or scolding or whatever. She very definitely is a mother, which brings me, I was going to tell about the six stages that I talk about in the book, On the Path of the Mother. And these also are over and over again until you finally reach that point where you have attained this oneness with all things. But the first stage is the getting to know the mother. And as you spoke in the beginning about how we already know, most of us know the mother. We know what mother is. We know from feeding at her breast. We know from her fixing our wounds when we've fallen off the roller skates or whatever. We know a mother's love. And so it's getting to know the universal mother in the way that we know our own mothers. I mean, maybe our mothers aren't perfect, you know, a lot of us. But even when our mothers aren't perfect, we know there's a perfect mother. We know they're not perfect. We know what that is. Something deep down in us knows what that is. And so we seek for that. Then the second thing is falling in love with the mother. And then that falling in love is so intense, far beyond even the falling in love with your husband or wife. It's like kind of like Rumi, you know, of the intoxication of the love. Then when you're in that stage, she's got you where she wants you, basically. And then she can begin to discipline you and show you where, you know, how to find what it is you're looking for. Then after that, after the discipline begins to lead you into the shadow area of your life and you begin to look at your down points, you know, the things that you may have accumulated over lifetimes and the things that are in there that you don't know about but she does. And so those things are so, you kind of can be so awful that eventually you're brought to your knees and you go, I don't have any control over this. I can't do it. And you surrender. You bow down. That's the fourth or the fifth stage will be this laying down and going, I can't do it. I need help. And only God can do this, or only the mother can do this. Only a mother will have enough compassion to take me on. So that surrender is very important, where you realize that you aren't the doer, that what it's she who's doing you. And so the more you can let her do you, the more happy you can be. So that's the last stage, is this contentment of just allowing that spirit to move in and through you in whatever form, you know, basically she. And then also what will happen during that stage that'll take you back to the beginning again is a yearning. You'll want to have that love so much that you'll do anything for it. So it makes those six stages repeat themselves accordingly until you finally attain the 100% love.
Can you explain how Amachi describes conquering the mind?
That's a very
loaded question.
That's a very loaded question. I don't know what she said. What did she say? Do you want to read it? What did she say?
Well, another common belief among scholars and teachers along the spiritual path is that we must conquer our mind, our senses, and the elements of nature. According to Amma, conquering simply means understanding. What is mine.
Okay.
To say that the five elements of nature are conquered does not mean that they cease to exist. Indeed, a living being is itself a combination of the five elements. Understanding is conquering. We began by wanting to conquer nature, only to realize at last that nature is itself God.
Oh, that's beautiful. What a beautiful quote you found. Yeah, I think that's the thing, that where we go so wrong in this Kali Yuga is that we think we're supposed to conquer, you know, that we're supposed to lord over or have power over, when certainly these hurricanes in Florida are showing us who's in power. You know, you get your voting machines a little bit off and who comes along, you know? but Mother Nature, and we can't control her. We have no power over her. We absolutely have none. And so now Ivan is on his way. And people, I don't think they realize that this is Mother Nature. You know, if she created the universe, of course she has power. And we have none. We have absolutely none. And so the power is in recognizing the power, as it said, in, as Mother says in there, of the elements, and going with them, working with these things. And this is what Chandra Pillai, too, up at the Los Alamos, also said the same thing. If only scientists could learn how to do science for the protection of nature. And Mother says the same. I call Mother, Amaji means mother. So when I'm saying mother, I'm referring to Amaji. And that we should be protecting nature rather than destroying her and trying to have power over her.
And this more than likely is why, if anything, this goddess incarnate has come into our midst, do you think? You know,
I mean, oh, absolutely. And she's, you know, it's funny. She sneaks in there. I mean, she's not somebody that you want to mess around with, but she's so lovely and sweet. You just can't stand it when you meet her. She's just so sweet. But she's been doing things gradually. You know, first of all, she has to win the love of the people. She has to do this second step and win their love. Not that she does it mentally or anything. It's just she naturally works with the elements. But she has been training women to be priests, and that's not happened for thousands of years. And so that was one of the things she did that was totally revolutionary, and people, you know, were very much against it. And now they're calling for these women to come and be priests in their activities in their homes. And then she went to the she was awarded the Gandhi King Award for nonviolence in Geneva, Switzerland, a couple of years ago. Nelson Mandela, Kofi Annan, and Jane Goodall had received these awards. And at that same time, there was a conference of women spiritual leaders. And Amma was the keynote speaker. And she comes right in there and tells very, very clearly, and it put a lot of men against her for a while because she was so clear that men are holding women back, but also she was very clear that women are letting men hold them back. She says it's like an elephant who learns, a baby elephant when he's tied to the tree learns that he can't move. But once that elephant goes up, that elephant can tear up that tree. That's how powerful that elephant is. Because it's been trained to stay, it doesn't do anything. So she says women are like that. They need to realize that they are that powerful as that elephant, and to stop just staying there pretending like they're tied to the tree. They must come forward and take equal balance with the controls, or the, not controls, we don't want to be controlling. But she talks like a bird flying with one wing. You know, a woman needs to be also flying with two wings.
One thing I don't want to leave out of this conversation, and it seems an appropriate time to bring it in now, is how men can also benefit from this relationship.
Absolutely.
Because I don't want to exclude men for any reason, and we're airing this program in December because of Christmas coming up, and I think it's really important for men to understand the divine feminine within.
This is absolutely true, and I kind of wish I'd brought a quote along about it, because Amaji herself says exactly what you're saying. That these qualities of motherhood, of patience, love, and forgiveness, men need also to adopt, and that is also part of their own inner nature. And if they could also adopt these qualities of love, patience, and forgiveness, then they would be so happy, not having to dominate. It would be, that would make them so much happier, being allowing the universe to take place through them and of them, and allowing themselves to enjoy the love of the mother also. They are also created, they're the mother's child as well. Men and women are the mother's children, and both are absolutely necessary. The balance of the universe depends on both of them. Finding, women also need to find their balance with the male nature as well, especially Indian women, Mother says. That there needs to be this balance of male and female in everyone. And men, because they now believe they have to be flying this bird with this only one wing, it makes it so hard for them. So if they can bring in the female element in them and allow the love of the mother as you say, Christmas time with the Mother Mary and the baby Jesus. If the men could see themselves as that baby Jesus, you know, and that baby Jesus, look what happened. Look who he became.
And yes, and you speak of, too, how Jesus embodied the qualities of the mother.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So, but through the love of the mother, a man can learn to embody that same love and achieve so much more in the universe. So much more, you know, bring us back into balance. We don't have to be fighting and killing others and putting other people down and other religions down in order to have happiness and peace.
Right. Yeah, it seems like a cultural revolution really needs to take place in that way, because it's hard for the few men that I know who've got that softness, especially if they have to work in jobs that entail the hardness.
Exactly. And this is one of the things that Amma mentions, too, is the man being able to tap into his ability to come home from that same job that you're talking about and relax and not deal with the people in the home, with his wife and his children, in the same way he deals with them in the office. You know, if he could come home and find that softness in himself, which he has, if he can just walk through the door and allow it to happen, then his family will be happier as well. He'll be happier. So it's very, very important. So important. And it is an interesting thing that we think we must, be so tough. But actually, if you look at how much we love somebody who isn't so tough, like, I'm sorry that I didn't want to get political, but I'm thinking of of Kerry, who, when he came home from Vietnam, was so, distraught at what was going on there. And I think he was even crying, and we've seen tears in his eyes that we like to see a man cry and have tears in his eyes, you know? Sorry, I didn't mean to bring politics into
That's okay. The election will be over by the time this airs, so we'll see where that goes. We'll see where that goes. But I also noticed with certain women, because of their own imbalances, that they find it very difficult to let a man be soft, you know, and I do believe it's because of their own lack of masculine presence in a way.
Well, yeah, and it's what Mother says about this, you know, having this rope that's tying them to the tree when they're really strong enough not to be tied to the tree. So if they will be happy to recognize their own strengths and not fear that they're going to lose a man because they've become strong, but that the two can grow together like this bird with two wings, not flying around in circles. Yeah, no, it's very difficult. Mother herself says how difficult this will be for women and men to change over the balance in that way, because we women do think we have to give up something of ourselves in order to please a man in a way which he really needs to be allowed to be soft.
Right. I'd like to remind listeners that we are speaking today on Alternative Currents with Savitri Bess, author of The Path of the Mother, published by Ballantine Books, and also a lovely book, Offer Me a Flower, A Spiritual Quest. We'll be back after the break.
From the dead. Within and without.
lovely break music from someone I lost touch with years ago, Carol Isis, that song Surrender from her album from 1986, You Are the Diamond. You can look at her current goings-on at isissongs.com. Beautiful voice.
Very beautiful.
Welcome back to our interview today with Savitri Bess, author of The Path of the Mother and Offer Me a Flower. Savitri, the concept of following a guru is pretty foreign to most Westerners. How can this kind of surrender be of benefit, and how does one guard against being taken advantage of by charlatans? What's the ultimate goal of this guru-disciple relationship?
You know, that's so deep and such a question that I want to deal with in my book and The Path of the Mother. But I don't go into everything about it because it's so complex. But let me just read something from Amma about it. She says, "Seeing only his body, people judge the guru externally. They project their own ignorance onto him. This is what makes them afraid to surrender. They think that the guru will control or snatch everything from them. They are afraid that he will take away their individuality and make them suffer. Because they see only the human form of the guru, they fear that they will be tricked by him. The guru is beyond the body. He is beyond being human. He is the embodiment of pure consciousness. In reality, he is formless and nameless. There is no person there, only nothingness. How can the formless, nameless guru snatch anything from you? How can he control you? He simply is, and you benefit from his presence." Okay, now the question is, how many of them are really like that?
Right.
And so I have the benefit of having had both. I had a person who I can't even call a guru anymore, because actually guru means God. It means what we've just been describing. It means a person who's, there's nobody there, who is simply is consciousness itself.
It's beyond and a channel then, really. It's beyond someone channeling.
Exactly. Yeah. It's totally beyond that, because there's no ego there. You can see it so much. And I experienced a guru with an ego, and I was very destroyed by it. I had a very, I lived in that ashram for many, many years, and I'm not going to even go into how badly I was damaged. But I'm fine now after being with Amaji, because she's a real guru. She is what we've just been reading about. She's absolutely has not even a tiny vested interest in anything. She wants nothing from you except that you get what you want. And ultimately, her job is to take you to enlightenment. And so it's like, she can't take anything from you. She can only give to you. This is what she is, like a river. It's a river of love. And if you want to get into it, get into it. And she'll take you to that ocean of love.
So really, it's just a person's experience that would teach them, you know, everything serves truly. So that if someone were to meet a teacher. See, I thought guru meant enlightened teacher or something like that. And perhaps that's a variation on the theme, huh?
How many are there in the world? Maybe five, two.
Yeah. Well, I think we hear it. I think we hear it used more commonly.
Yeah.
I just watched an interesting documentary on Ayurveda. Mm. And one of the physicians, the Ayurvedic physicians, was calling all of his teachers gurus. And so that's, I guess.
Yeah, it is another word. Pundit is also used, and it means priest. It's a word that's been sort of coined to mean anybody who's a master of something.
Okay.
Doesn't matter. You know, you can be the guru mechanic in your car. But if you're going for spiritual enlightenment, you want the one that's the God, you know, that is basically it.
Okay.
Like you say, it's beyond being a channel.
Right. What does Amaji have to say about religious leaders who interpret scripture?
Well, you know, she has a very profound thing to say on it, and I don't know if I can speak it as well as she does. But basically, she you've got the page. Let's see here. She basically says that religion contains the essential principles of life by which egotism and narrow-mindedness are eliminated. But sometimes, due to lack of proper understanding, the same religions become a breeding ground for these negative qualities. And basically what she says is that a lot of what happened with religion is that the people who were in charge of the religions wanted this thing that we were talking about earlier. They wanted power. They thought they were more powerful than the hurricane, basically. And so through the desire of power means that you're also going to seek power over others. So it means you're going to not really show people what the true religion is. And basically, Amma describes the religion as being like the cover on an orange or the peel on an orange, and that the spirituality is on the inside. So actually, religion can be used to get to the spirituality, which leads you to the divine within you, which leads you to the love. But sometimes what happens in religions is that they focus on the peel. And of course, an orange peel doesn't taste very good, you know. I mean, it you have to be able to understand how to get into the fruit. And the religion can lead you into the fruit, but the trouble is these ones who've chosen to take power over instead of leading you to the spirituality, to the actual fruit that's sweet and wonderful. Basically, that's what she says has happened. It's all religions will take you to the same truth. But the people who run those religions tend to want power instead of taking people to the truth. They want people to know the truth.
I spent about an hour with a friend on the phone last night and read her a significant portion of the creation story that you related in this book. I'd really like you to run that down for listeners because it moved me that deeply.
Now, which story was that?
The Adam and Eve.
That was so... That was one of those things. It was so interesting. What am I going to write about the shadow? I had no idea what I was going to write about the religious shadow. I sat down at my computer, and that's what came out. And, you know, you kind of have to read it, but I presented it like you would a mystery story. You know, okay, so here you have these two people in the Garden of Eden. And of course, all the views, all the ways we look at the Adam and Eve story are all truth. You know, so the one that I present is another truth. It's not saying that other truths of that story aren't also true. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
It has multiple levels.
Oh, yeah.
So my sense was, okay, here are these two people and this snake comes along who is a known representative of the feminine, the goddess. And at that time in Judaism, they were wanting not to have these other goddesses and gods in the religion, especially the goddess. They were wanting a monotheism. And so this snake thing was then presented, became evil instead of became representing the goddess. So when that, if you look at it as the snake being the goddess is saying, okay, here's how you get to the fruit, right? Here's how you get through the peel. And even the apple is used. So the apple, she's saying, you know, eat this because this is going to give you the knowledge. And so, of course, you know, Eve, who's the woman, and again, this is the story that we were talking about before. She's a woman who at that moment realizes she's big enough to tear down the tree, you know, that the elephant
like the
is tied
elephant,
to. Tied
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
And so she takes the apple and eats of it and then gives some to Adam. And then, of course, God gets very angry. And it's at that point, too, I don't know if this is what you were telling me about, but at this point I also realized the extent to which the God of the Hebrew tradition is very similar to all of the pantheons in all of the different cultures of the world. And that he was acting very much like Indra in Hinduism, who was always getting angry when people didn't do what he wanted them to do. And so here's this Hebrew God getting really mad. And I'm not saying, you know, but please understand that I'm not taking away from the other interpretations of this. This was just what came to me. And so, but it's also good to get a perspective and to recognize that they probably were taking from the personality characteristics of different gods, and especially like Thor also used to get very angry, and so did
Zeus.
And so it wasn't unusual for the gods to get angry. Thing is, they're supposed to do anger for the better, not for the bad. So here these two are then thrown out of the Garden of Eden, and that tree, which was then forbidden for anybody to ever reach it. They put up those flames around it and said nobody could come to this tree anymore. And then she was cursed to have to crawl the earth like a snake. And And of course, she accepted it, which is what we were talking about before, because she realized it, this was the time to accept this position. You know, everything comes in cycles. So for some reason, the woman accepted the position of this lower position for whatever evolution in humanity during this Kali Yuga, because that was the time of the Kali Yuga when it began, that whatever evolution had to take place, and now 4,000 years later, it's time to change that balance back again. I don't know if that's what you wanted me to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly brought that about. And then also the fact that in spite of all this, Eve was still named Eve because...
Because she was... What was it?
What is the translation of the name Eve?
You tell me.
He said Adam had named Eve, which actually means acknowledge her as the mother of all living.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wow. That's beautiful.
So in spite of this. And then, you know, to play that through into original sin, let me just read from your book. Adam and Eve are portrayed as being foolish for having made the choice to eat of the fruit of knowledge. Their decision is cast as one that became known as sin. Rather than encouraging Adam and Eve to use the wisdom taught by the serpent, the scribes depict God as having punished them for the innocent desire for knowledge and instilling into man and woman the emotion of shame without hope of release from it, an outcome that might be considered the true original sin.
Nice. And that answers your question about the men and the women now and women needing to come up. I mean, that because there's a shame involved in it. There is still shame. We women live with a lot of shame. And so men don't tend to live with the same kind of shame, I don't think. Now, I may be wrong. You guys call me up on the phone and let me know, but I don't think it's quite as
Notice she's
as
not
strong.
Giving a phone number here. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's
I think
not quite
we do
as strong.
Have it. Yeah, I think we do have it, but also interesting is the times of day and how they correlate with the ancestors and you know, twilight and day and night and so on. Yes.
You mean the way the demons come out at night and that particular part of it, the way the gods are strong by day and the demons are strong by night.
Right.
And the ancestors are strong by twilight and the men are strong by dawn.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And so how that's an interesting cyclical kind of way of looking at how our personal demons come to call on us. But also I was thinking of how the shame or how these kinds of things that we're dealing with actually come through DNA, I mean, come through our ancestors.
Nice, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The things that we're dealing with now are not just ours that we're dealing with.
Absolutely.
I mean, according
absolutely.
To these other cultures.
And even the Bible says, you know, the seventh generations, if you can heal yourself in this generation, you will heal seven generations behind you.
Yeah.
So absolutely,
and
we make a very
of the Father,
big yeah.
The Son. Yeah.
But speaking of, I don't know if you want me to go into this now, but speaking of, you know, my particular dark side element you know, expresses itself in anger and a very anger that's, you know, similar to a hurricane in the sense that I didn't ever seem to have any control of it. I seem to now to some but when I first came to Amma, I didn't have control over it. And when I was at the ashram, I'd flare off. I'd go off the handle. I think I, the story of when I was drinking this ghee during the Ayurveda, I took an Ayurvedic course and I had to drink this graduated amounts of medicated ghee. And it got to my liver, but it also was probably doing something on a very other kind of a level.
Well, his liver is where we hold anger
in
the body.
Yes, where we hold anger. And so I went to the doctor to tell him I couldn't do it anymore. And I knocked on the door, and this doctor who has trouble with anger himself opened the door like a little crack and said, I can't deal with you right now. And I was at a state, I'd been waiting to talk to them for the whole day to tell them I didn't want to do this. And I got absolutely livid. Here I am on a balcony overlooking the sand where the other people are walking around and everything. I picked up everything in sight and started swearing like a sailor and throwing tin cups and water bottles. And it was like I was just totally livid. And then I saw the monks all gathered together down below start running towards where I was, and I escaped back to the woman's dorm. But it was like I went to Amma, who had been away at the time, and to ask her if I should continue with the program because of what, and I told her what happened.
The healing protocol, mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I should continue with the healing, with the Ayurvedic healing. And I told her how angry I had gotten. I figured I had to be really honest with her in order to heal. And she just said, "Child, you look much better than you've ever looked before. Continue with the program." So I did. Meanwhile, you know, this anger thing became a problem, so that one day I wrote her a message, a note, and I took it up. You take the notes up to her in when you get the hug, when you get your hug. She hugs everybody. And so I took the note up, and I told I wanted to get rid of my anger, and she, we only have a few more minutes? Okay, I'll make it. Okay. So anyway, she started laughing. She was just laughing and laughing and laughing, and she called out my name, and she got me laughing too. So there we are laughing away, and she's going, "Zombie tree." And then I just went like, you know, I shrugged my shoulders and went like this, like, what, you know, what do I do? She said, "Throw your Amma doll." Well, I didn't have an Amma doll, so I went and bought one. They were just starting to make these little dolls that look like Amma. But I never could bring myself to throw it. Probably should have. But anyway, then the whole thing progressed. There came a time where I wrote a really long note that I sent through her attendant. And I didn't get an answer. For weeks, I didn't get an answer. So I went up for a hug, and I was terrified because I had a little note. Did you get my note? You know? And she played with me on the way up and made me jump. She started yelling at somebody, and it made me jump. And she said, yes, she'd gotten my note. And I asked this woman, did you give Amma my note? And she said, no, I didn't. And I said, well, she said she got it. You know, she must have gotten it on some of the list. They say she gets the notes as soon as you write them. So then, a few years later, I went to her again about this anger problem, and at that time, I was finally ready to hear what the difficulty was. Before, she was giving me the loving yourself, you know, love yourself. Don't worry about it, but love yourself. And in other words, it was allowed. Laughing, you know, she laughed. Throw your Amma doll. And this time, she told me why. And it was fascinating. She said it's because in this lifetime and past lives, you did not receive the proper love, and that when you gave love, it was not received. And it was just so extraordinary for me to hear why this had gone on. Of course, she says everybody has this problem. So many people, 90% of the population have this problem. So it wasn't just mine, but she added a few little things to mine, like when you give love, it's not received. Then she told me, she said, you're like a drainage ditch where the river, I mean, it's not a beautiful image, but still, you know, she was being honest with me, which I liked at that point. I wouldn't have been able to take it that few years before, you know, when I first went. So I wanted to hear. She said, it's like a drainage ditch where the river comes in and cleans the drainage ditch out, and it takes some time for it to get cleaned out. And I realized, of course, she was the river that was cleaning out the drainage ditch. She said, it's like a fruit that's not quite ripe. You know, it's going to be sour until it gets ripe. And so then, most recently, when an anger problem came up really, really badly, this is, we're talking now, 10 years later after meeting her finally, she actually began yelling at me, scolding me, telling me people are afraid of me, but she did it so skillfully. She said, people are afraid of you, but yet so-and-so, they like you very much, you know, blah, blah, blah. She would go back and forth like that. When she gets mad, it's really kind of scary, scary looking. And she told me I wasn't allowed to get angry anymore. It was so extraordinary. I must have cried for hours because I felt like if she told me not to, that means I can do it. That means it's possible. If she's told me not to, you're not supposed to disobey the guru. So if she's told me not to get angry, then it's going to be possible for me not to get angry anymore. And so it was, I just cried and cried and cried and cried because it's such a prison. It has been such a prison for me, and she basically released me from it. I've never gotten angry in the same way since, and this has been about probably 2 years, year and a half. So
Well, in, it seems in Western psychology too, there's a lot of practice that asks us to encourage the expression of anger. But I know it's true with the Chinese, and probably also true with some Indian practices, that expressing anger is like unleashing something that continues.
It begets
erupting.
It begets anger. That's what I've found. And it's like a high. Whenever I would get angry, I'd always feel really good for like maybe an hour or maybe 15 minutes. I would feel really good after getting angry. It was like some sort of a high,
like a release
that I had. Too, yeah. And then I would go into such remorse. It would be, you know, I'd die for, in the beginning, I'd die for years and then months and then days, you know. And so, you know, there's nothing wrong with anger if it's not expressed with some sort of attachment from past.
And that's the tricky part.
And I think that's the tricky part. Like mother, she'll say that it's very important for mothers, for instance, to have a show of anger, she calls it, to children, to discipline them. But to, or to be angry, yell at somebody, don't go across the street, you know, there's a car coming or something like that, or quickly tell somebody stop doing that, you know. But to have this anger coming from years or lifetimes of suffering or lifetimes of having done really nasty things to other people, who knows, you know, you don't have to know. You just have to release it. And I feel like, I mean, I'm not saying I don't still have a tendency towards that, but I don't have to express it anymore. And, I mean, in other words, I can stop it.
Well, I think most of us, I think most of us who are familiar with anger and who isn't really, but those of us who've really had an issue with it, kind of know the difference between anger that holds a charge and anger that is simply strong feelings being expressed.
Exactly.
So I think really deep down we know
exactly
the difference.
Exactly. We do know the difference. And it, for me, it was never possible. It was like a volcano erupting. I couldn't stop it. And now I just, I mean, I can just bow down to the trees, to the earth, to the sky, to everything in gratefulness for, and to Amma in most particular, because she brought me to that place.
Again, I'd like to remind listeners, we, if you've tuned in recently, we're speaking with Savitri Bess, author of The Path of the Mother, published by Ballantine Books, available everywhere. And also a really lovely fictional account, maybe fictional, called Offer Me a Flower. I guess there's a lot of your personal story.
It's fictionalized.
In that. Yes. Yeah.
It's fictionalized.
But it'd be really very engaging. I really couldn't put it down. I looked at it as some kind of new agey thing, and I was like, oh, I don't know. And then when I finally picked it up and started reading it, I couldn't put it down. It really was quite engaging and full of wisdom. And so I would recommend that. What are some ways in which a person can call on Divine Mother or invite her into their lives, especially as we're headed into the holiday season? You know, how can we get some balance there and kind of pay homage or respect to Divine Mother and create space for her in our lives and in our throughout the holidays for ourselves?
Well, you know, in my book, I do have a practice for that, because the Mother is available to everybody in all religions. And it's a matter of being able to remember her all the time. And so what I suggested in the book, I give different ideas for how to do that, because everybody's going to have, like, at Christmas time, of course, we're going to be focused on Mary, you know. And so if Mary is how you see the Mother in the deepest way, then you want to remember Mary all the time, you know, not just on Sunday and not just on, you know, Christmas. But we want to. But at Christmas is a good time, because she's very alive at Christmas time. There's that, her energy is available for us at Christmas time, and if you go to church, you can get it even more. You know, at Christmas, I always go to church at Christmas time, because that energy is there. They've arrived. You know, Jesus and Mary, they arrive at the church. I mean, not that they're not there all the time, but they really arrive at Christmas, and so you can get that. That holiness. Also, Easter is a good time to do it too, because there you have Mother in another kind of way. Oops, you're going counting down.
Please don't worry about that.
Anyway, the whole idea, like, let's say you believe in Isis, or let's say you're a Persephone devotee, or you're a devotee, whoever you're a devotee of, whoever you pour your heart out to, that you see as your perfect example of the Mother, you want to remember that all the time. Every day. And to help you do that, you can create your own little mantra around it. You know, I mean, in if you're Catholic, they already have really good mantras. You know, they have your beads. So you take your beads out and use those beads all the time. In Hinduism, we also have, you know, the prayer beads. And they're to say, you say the name, Ma. Ma means mother. That's so easy, Ma.
It's pretty universal.
On the beads, yeah. Ma, Ma, yeah. Ma, 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 over and over and over again. Even Amaji, when you come up and you get your hug, that's what she says in your ear. Ma, 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 Ma. And so you can use that as a mantra. The just Ma, as we know it so well. We know it from when we're a child. Even that mother didn't come to us. We called out Ma, Ma, Ma. So you can call out like that. And I think that's the idea. And then picture yourself as that baby Jesus in her lap. And
Taking in all that
qualities love.
Qualities of patience and...
Love and forgiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. And this seems as good a time as any to Anne. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Bella. It was my pleasure.
Yes. And again, this has been Savitri Bess, author of The Path of the Mother, published by Valentine Books, and Offer Me a Flower. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and talk to you next year.
Jai Ma Shiva.